Chapter 42. The Seahawk helicopter flew without its running lights 25 feet above the sea, almost skimming the wave tops as it sped toward the atoll at 200 miles an hour. Tension in the cockpit mounted as the chopper neared its destination, but Austin remained an island of calm. He sat in the passenger seat, dressed in a lightweight wetsuit, his eyes fixed on a satellite-generated hybrid chart spread out on his lap, etching every detail into his brain. He had marked 3 X's on the chart with a grease pencil. The first X showed the position, a quarter mile from the atoll where the helicopter would drop him off. The second X showed the narrow breach in the coral reef. The third X, from overhead, showed the dark streak in the lagoon. The pilot's voice came over the headphones. 5-minute warning, Kurt. Austin folded the chart and put it in a waterproof chest pack. He pulled a plastic pouch that protected his Bowen revolver out of the pack, checked the load, and tucked it back inside. Then he unbuckled his seat belt and stood by the Seahawk's open door. The helicopter slowed, then hovered over the predetermined point of insertion. "Showtime, Kurt," the pilot said. "Thanks for the ride," Austin said. "We'll have to do it again sometime when I can stay longer." The chopper's co-pilot helped Austin push a 6-foot-long inflatable boat out the door, and they lowered it into the sea using a motorized winch. Austin grabbed a 2-inch line rigged to the helicopter's hoist bracket and slid down the rope, his hands protected by thick gloves. He then lowered himself into the sea and let go. The Seahawk moved away from the insertion point to prevent its rotors from whipping up the water. Austin breaststroked over to the inflatable and climbed aboard. It was stabilized by the weight of the gear pack secured to its makeshift wooden platform between its pontoons. He detached a flashlight from his belt, pointed it at the noisy silhouette hanging over the water, and blinked it several times to signal that he was set. Its job done, the Seahawk darted off and within seconds disappeared into the night. Austin undid the tie-downs holding the supply pack and pulled out a paddle. He found a waterproof pouch that contained a handheld GPS and pushed the power button. The tiny green screen blinked on and it showed his position in relation to the island. He tucked the GPS back in its pouch and began to paddle. It was a gorgeous night. The stars glittered like diamond splinters against the black velvet of the tropical sky, and the sea was on fire, glowing with silvery green phosphorescence. There was little current and no wind, and he covered the distance in good time. Hearing the whisper of waves washing against the reef, he squinted against the darkness and saw the faint white line of breaking waves. He checked the GPS again and followed the course it suggested to take him to the break in the reef. But he ran into trouble as he approached the narrow opening in the coral. The water surged in and out of the break to create a barrier of turbulence that tossed the lightweight boat around like a rubber duck in a bathtub. Paddling vigorously, Austin brought the bow around and charged into the opening, but again failed to muster the power necessary to overcome the cross-currents. He made another try. This time he yelled, "Once more unto the breach!" But the inspired words of Shakespeare's Henry V were no match for the power of the sea. All he got for his trouble was a mouthful of seawater. After his failed attempts, Austin admitted to himself that the sea was just playing with him, and he paddled away from the reef to reconnoiter. As the inflatable rocked in the waves, he caught his breath. Then he extracted a lightweight, electric-powered outboard motor and battery from the pack, clamped the motor to the platform, and punched ignition. Except for a soft hum, the motor was almost silent. He goosed the throttle and aimed the inflatable's blunt bow at the creamy surf welling up around the opening in the reef. The inflatable bounced, fishtailed, and yawed. For a second, Austin gritted his teeth, thinking he was going to be thrown sideways into the jagged coral. Then the outboard's propeller blades caught water, and the inflatable squeezed through the opening and glided into the peaceful lagoon. Austin quickly killed the motor and waited. 5 minutes passed, and there was nothing to indicate he had been detected. No blinding searchlights, no hail of bullets to herald his arrival. Austin took the lack of a warm reception as an invitation to stay. He dug his scuba gear out of the pack, buckling on his lightweight air tank and buoyancy compensator. He checked his GPS and saw that the inflatable had been thrown slightly off course after passing through the reef. He began to paddle until the little black triangle on the GPS's screen showed he was back on course. A few minutes later, the triangle merged with the circle marking where the satellite showed the dark streak in the lagoon. The submarine he had seen in the satellite image seemed to have sprung from the floor of the lagoon before it vanished magically from sight. The inexplicable disappearance of the typhoon suggested that there was more to the lagoon than met the eye. Austin had no logical reason to assume the lagoon's waters were not as shallow as they looked from space, but he took no chances, and had borrowed a tank containing a Trimix mixture from the new research vessel in the event that he had to make a deeper dive than expected. Austin pulled on his face mask and fins, chomped on his regulator mouthpiece, hoisted himself belly down onto the inflatable's right pontoon, then rolled off into the lagoon. Water seeped between the neoprene and his skin and gave him a momentary chill until it warmed to an insulating body temperature. He held on to the side of the inflatable for a few seconds, then he pushed himself away, jackknifed as he dove under the surface and descended about 20 feet. As Austin neared the floor of the lagoon, he reached out with his gloved right hand. Instead of touching sand, his fingers pushed against a soft, yielding surface. His coral blue eyes narrowed behind the lens of the mask. He removed the glove and discovered that what he thought was sand, overgrown with marine life, was a loosely woven net covered with an irregular pattern of colors. Austin slid his knife from its sheath on his thigh, pressed the point into the fabric, and pushed. With only slight pressure, the blade penetrated the net. He sawed a cut in the net several inches long, withdrew the blade, returned it to its sheath, and glided over the fake ocean bottom until he came to where he had seen the streak in the satellite picture. He saw from a few inches away that the streak was in fact a partially mended tear in the fake bottom. The uneven nylon stitching looked as if it had been done hastily. Austin unhooked a dive light from his vest. Holding the light straight out in front of him, Austin squirmed through the opening. He brought his body straight up, paddling with his fins as if he were on a bicycle, and spun around slowly. About midway through his 360 pivot, he halted and stared with wonder. About 100 feet away was a massive object, faintly illuminated by wavy starlight filtering through the net. No details were clearly visible, but it was obviously an enormous submarine. Austin instinctively switched the light off, even though it seemed unlikely that anybody aboard the sub was aware of his insignificant presence. He swam away from the submarine and saw pinpoints sparkling in the darkness below. He angled his body and dove straight down, only to stop after a few moments to stare at a line of glowing blue objects. Blue Medusae. About 6 of them floated across his path of descent. He waited until the deadly jellyfish were out of range, then dove again toward the bottom. As he dove down, he saw that the lights that had first caught his attention were beacons on the tops of 4 large spheres built around a hemispheric hub. Each rested on 4 spindly legs, with disc-shaped footings that resembled the legs of a spider. The metal surface of the globes was unbroken with the exception of 1 sphere which had a transparent dome. Austin swam closer to the sphere and saw 2 people under the dome. One was a dark-haired woman, and the other was Zavala. The 2 were sitting in chairs, apparently deep in conversation. Zavala didn't seem to be in any trouble, and from the look on his face, he was enjoying himself. Austin guffawed, the deep laugh coming out as a series of noisy bubbles. Only Joe Zavala could find an attractive woman at the bottom of the sea. While Austin was trying to make sense of the scene under the dome, the woman looked straight up at him and stared. He peeled off like a fighter plane, swam down to the bottom and under the sphere, then toward the hemispheric hub. He remembered from the diagram that the hub was the transportation module. It had an airlock at the top of it for the cargo shuttle. He swam under the module past four submersibles hanging from the bottom of the hemisphere and found the hatch that allowed divers access to the module. He inflated the buoyancy compensator. Air from the tank flowed into the vest and he began a slow rise. At the same time, he removed the waterproof pouch holding the Bowen from his pack. He figured he could have the pistol out and ready to fire within 5 seconds of surfacing. With the element of surprise, that should give him the edge he needed. Austin's head broke the surface of the airlock pool inside the hemisphere. He pushed his mask up on his forehead, glanced quickly around, and saw that the Bowen wouldn't be needed and could stay in its pouch for now. The circular room was deserted. He swam over to a ladder and put the pouch on the edge of the pool, making sure it was within easy reach. Then he slipped out of his weight belt, fins, and tank, and set them next to the pouch. He climbed out, retrieved the Bowen from its pouch, and hung his scuba gear on a hook next to four other sets of dry gear. Then he listened for a minute at the only door. All was quiet. Austin's Bowen filled one hand and his other pressed the wall switch. The door slid quietly open. Austin set off along a corridor, determined to stir up some trouble. It didn't take long. He came to a door marked Resource Cultivation Section. He opened it and stepped into a twilit chamber that was circular in shape, the walls lined with fish tanks that contained various jellyfish. But it was the larger, chest-high, circular tank at the center of the room that caught his attention. It contained at least a dozen giant jellyfish. Their bell-shaped bodies were nearly a yard across, and their tentacles were short, thick, and ropey, rather than the delicate streaming filaments seen on most jellyfish. They glowed with a pulsating neon blue that provided the sole illumination in the room. He saw a movement that didn't come from inside the tank. A distorted face was reflected in the curving glass surface. Absorbed by the strange forms in the central tank, Austin had let himself get sloppy. The Bowen dangled at the end of his arm near his thigh. He whirled and raised the gun, but the powerfully built guard who had been quietly stalking Austin brought the metal stock of his machine pistol down, and it hit the flesh inside of Austin's wrist. The Bowen flew from his fingers and clattered on the floor, and a fiery pain shot up to his shoulder. Austin's right arm was momentarily useless, but with his left hand he reached up and grabbed the machine pistol. As he tried to wrench the weapon from the man's grasp, his assailant pushed him back against the tank. He slammed against the glass wall, but Austin kept a tight grip on the gun, pushed it up and away from his body, and managed to twist the machine pistol away. His fingers lacked the strength to hold on to the weapon, and it splashed into the tank. The giant jellyfish scattered in every direction. Both men stared at the lost weapon, but Austin was the first to rally. He kept his useless arm close to his side, lowered his head, and butted the man in the chest, driving him back toward the wall. They both slammed against the row of tanks, dislodging a couple that crashed to the floor and broke open. The gelatinous creatures in the tanks spilled across the floor. Austin lost his footing in the slippery mess and went down on one knee. He struggled to stand again, and the man kicked him in the side of the face. But the man slipped in the slimy glop in his second attempt to kick Austin's head through the goalposts. The blow glanced off Austin's cheek, rattling his teeth, and knocked him over on his right side. The man, regaining his balance, produced a knife from a sheath hanging from his belt and let out a yell. He dove on Austin with knife raised high. Austin brought his left arm up in what he knew was a futile attempt to block the blade, but at the last second, his groping gloved hand snatched up a shard of glass 8 inches long, and he plunged it into the man's neck. He heard a gargled shriek of pain and felt a shower of warm blood from the severed jugular. The knife dropped from the man's fingers. He tried to get to his feet, only to crumple on rubbery legs as the life drained from his body. Austin rolled out of the way before the man crashed down on him and got unsteadily to his feet. His right wrist was on fire, and he had to use his left hand to retrieve his Bowen. as he stepped carefully around the spreading pool of blood and dozens of dying jellyfish, he took a quick glance at the big tank. The giant mutant jellyfish glowed even brighter. It was as if they had enjoyed the blood sport. Austin wasted no time putting the nightmarish scene behind him. He set off down a corridor to search for Zavala, wondering what other delightful surprises Davy Jones's locker would have to offer.